Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 346, Saturday, September 21st, 2019.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, KMO here, and I'm going to start off by reading a piece of email. This comes from Philip. Philip writes, "Hey KMO, I just finished listening to Sea Realm Vault episode number 445. Thanks for continuing to deliver interesting content. After hearing you reiterate that you don't have much contact with millennials, I thought I'd reach out. Born in 1988 and now 31 years old, I'm usually right in the middle of the millennial age range. I was fortunate to attend a private liberal arts college from 2006 to 2010, so I felt the effect of the Great Recession when I graduated and got stuck with the student debt typifying my generation. My future looked pretty uncertain right around the time peak oil was most popular, so, like you, I became obsessed with that for a while. My politics were strongly influenced by the rise of Barack Obama. I co-founded the Students for Obama group on my campus, but the Great Awakening arrived after I left my very left-leaning campus. These days, I look to AOC, a.k.a. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, whom I greatly admire, to represent my generational interests in politics. It's obviously difficult to represent a whole generation, but no, I'm here if you ever want to, quote, ask a millennial, close quote. Best, Phil. P.S. You convinced me that I should consider Andrew Yang more seriously. I checked out his platform today and found it very interesting." So, I took Phil up on his offer, got him on Zoom, and we recorded a pretty lengthy conversation. Here's the first half of it. And now, I am joined by the author of that email. His name is Phil, and he is in Baltimore, Maryland, and he is a Sea Realm Vault subscriber, has been since pretty darn near the beginning of the Sea Realm Vault podcast. Phil, thanks for talking to me.
Glad to be here.
So in the email that, from the listener's perspective, I just read, you mentioned, you echoed something that I've said, which is that I've spent a long time, you know, before I encountered the peak oil story, I was very much a techno-utopian. And I thought that advancing technology was moving the world in a very promising direction. And it was largely because I was at a very low place in my life that I was open to the very antithesis of that message. And you said something, maybe not exactly the same happened for you, but something similar enough that you took note of it. Would you start off talking about that?
Sure. Yeah, I don't think I realized it at the time, back in 2009 or sort of wherever peak oil hit its peak, so to speak. but I, at that point in my life, I was graduating college in 2010. So I was in college and the Great Recession had hit. And growing up, I think that I believed, like pretty much everybody did for generations in the United States, that I would be better off, or at least as well off in my career and in my sort of standard of living as my parents. And all of a sudden, right as I'm about to hit adult life, comes this Great Recession, and it put me into a situation where I doubted how I was going to do. I read so many articles about how millennials were struggling, the older sort of millennials, and how they would continue to struggle once they got out of college. So I think that put me in a place where I was really concerned about peak oil and about sort of just environmental catastrophe. I had been primed, I guess you could say, by being woken up to just environmentalism, not just when I was a kid through my mother, but also through Al Gore's film and, you know, revealing the big problem of climate change. So I think once I had that awareness and I was put into a position in my life where I wasn't really sure how I was going to do, peak oil was attractive as an idea. And that really continued as I went into graduate school. I decided that I wanted to work to transform America's transportation capabilities. And I had spent some time in Denmark, and I got to live the everyday experience of getting around by public transit and walking. That really made a great impression on me. And when I came back to the United States, it was very difficult. So that compounded the peak oil sort of sensitivities that I already had, thinking about how are we going to get by in the United States when we're so dependent on automobile. And that sort of reverse culture shock, I think, put me further down into the peak oil narrative. And it was a very attractive idea that Americans would be forced to give up their lifestyle of driving everywhere, because that seemed like an easy way out of this situation. And looking back on it, it was sort of the way that I could get what I wanted psychologically. And, you know, you see this in James Howard Kunstler and his talks and his writing, that he really wants to see this different kind of country and different kind of society. And these big political, environmental forces behind it would help make that happen. As peak oil sort of has faded away, I've had to come to just sort of accept that it's not going to be that easy, which is feels odd to say, because peak oil was seen as a catastrophe, and it wouldn't be easy for the people living it. But yet, for the ideals I had for where we wanted to end up, it would help us get us there.
It's easy to envision.
It's easy to envision, yes, definitely.
Whereas, continuing as we are, particularly with, shale oil, the production costs of shale oil now in the United States are at parity with, and still falling, but they're at parity with crude oil production in Saudi Arabia. So, the idea that a fuel shortage is what's going to derail the United States is completely off the table.
Yeah, at least for now, it sure is.
For many decades.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's just for oil. I mean, right now, natural gas, which is, mostly methane, but a few other things as well, is a byproduct of shale oil drilling. It's a waste product. I mean, they don't even capture it for the most part. They just flare it. And you can see it from space, these enormous fields of flame leaping up from the ground because they're igniting the natural gas before letting it escape. And, natural gas is a tough one because it is a gas, and it's not anywhere close to oil in terms of energy density. So to make it even worth, having around, you have to condense it to about 200 times the, normal atmospheric pressure, which means it's dangerous to transport. It is difficult to transport, and it is really difficult and unproductive to try to store it. So you have to create an infrastructure that is sort of a just-in-time, transport it and use it as soon as it reaches its destination. But even so, the United States is in a great position in terms of, being able to do that in terms of our established infrastructure. And coal plants are being converted to natural gas plants left and right. Coal is basically a dead industry here in the United States because of natural gas.
Sure, it's going that way. And I don't think many people think about how natural gas, my understanding of it isn't great, but it basically runs like water, through pipelines across the country.
But it has to be pressurized. So, a leak is much more dangerous than, the leak in a water main.
Definitely. Yeah, that's true.
But, you can freeze it and it becomes a liquid. And then it is more easy to transport via tanker or by truck or things like that, but that's not nearly as economical as pipelines. The major obstacle to creating the natural gas infrastructure right now is just the political and social pushback against the construction of new pipelines.
Yeah, I remember discussions when I was living in New England about potentially setting up terminals at some of the ports for liquid natural gas. And it came up sort of all of a sudden because it wasn't, it went from a resource that we just used, and then one that we really had an overabundance of and we wanted to export.
You know, you've mentioned not since we've been recording, you know, for the podcast, but in our previous discussion and in your email that you worked on the Obama campaign.
When was that? Yeah, a bit. So I didn't work directly for the campaign, but I set up a Students for Obama group on my college campus. I entered college in the fall of 2006, and so I really saw Barack Obama's rise from a potential candidate to actually declaring his candidacy, and I thought it was very exciting. You know, I spent my teenage years under President Bush, and for someone who was
George W. Bush. When I graduated high school, Ronald Reagan was the president.
Yeah, well, and it really shapes our experiences. I think that's high school is a very formative point in everybody's lives and finding their political identity. And the United States has been at war since I was 13 years old, and so I looked at these wars, and here was this candidate, Barack Obama, who was against the Iraq war, and I was just basically like, sign me up. This is great. And, you know, he was a really young guy too, so I think that helped as well. And he really captured, I don't need to say this, but he really captured America's sense of, well, maybe we can be something better. And that was a very attractive thought, that maybe we could be past all of these racial and other issues, that we really could unite the country. You know, I was in college. I don't think I realized what Mitch McConnell was going to do once Barack Obama got elected. But it was very exciting to help out in the campaign. One of the things that I did was I sold tickets to a rally that he held at Boston University, which is not where I attended college, but it was pretty close by, and he could get a big arena space. And students were so excited that they were paying more than $20 a ticket to go to this. And I think I ended up raising over $1,000 with a couple of friends who founded the organization with me. And for cheap, broke college students, you know, that I think means a lot, that people were going to pay good money to go be a part of this experience. So then after that, I helped campaign for him in New Hampshire. I had a group actually that was founded out of, funny, the Dean for America turned into Democracy for America. And we had a local chapter that was focused on electing progressive Democrats. And we sort of adopted a town in New Hampshire, and we would go up there on weekends and go door to door, try and convince people to vote for Barack.
So what was it like having been a very enthusiastic supporter, you know, of Obama as he was coming up for his first election, to live through the 8 years of the Obama presidency?
Well, in short, it was a big letdown. I had such high hopes, you know, seeing that the Democrats had the House and the Senate for a brief time had a filibuster-proof majority, and all that we could accomplish was basically the same level of healthcare that I had as a resident of Massachusetts. We just took the Massachusetts plan that Mitt Romney, a Republican, created and made it nationwide, and that wasn't the big transformational change that I was looking for. I don't know what other people's expectations were, but that was a big letdown. And after that, I didn't want to give any money to the Democratic Party. I, you know, did still dedicate time to, you know, electing progressive candidates to Congress, but it just showed me that it's so difficult to get anything done. And then I had mentioned earlier that the two wars were really on my mind growing up, and seeing that they weren't really coming to an end under Barack Obama, that was also very disappointing, and that we were going to actually increase the number of troops we had in Afghanistan. It just wasn't what I was looking for.
How long did it take for that disappointment to sink in?
Well, I can tell you I didn't vote for him in 2012. I actually voted for Jill Stein. So I guess it was less than 4 years. And through all that time, when I would talk with other students or family members or whomever, regardless of their political affiliation, I was still proud of being a part of electing him because I think that was meaningful. But yeah, I told people, you know, I don't want to vote for more war. And if this is all we can do, we need to go for somebody who's going to be even more progressive.
Well, in the George W. Bush administration, we got the concept of an enemy combatant, who is a person who has no rights and can be killed, you know, without any legal proceedings, but who is not a soldier in a foreign nation's army, and so is not accorded the rights that we give to prisoners of war either.
It's a convenient way around all of the international law regarding these sorts of foreign conflicts, isn't it?
Yeah, which, you know, as I've described it, I mean, I hope I've described it in a way that makes it sound like an abhorrent concept. And yet the Obama administration took it a step further and said that an enemy combatant can be an American citizen, and that the executive branch has the right to murder such people without trial, without charging them with any sort of crime, you know, just deciding that they are somehow an enemy of the U.S., they can be killed.
Yeah, it's really horrible. I think the interesting thing about it from my point of view is that I think everybody who supported Barack Obama and people on the left side of the political spectrum, we all thought, well, that couldn't possibly happen to us, right? When George Bush got the Patriot Act passed, we all thought, well, maybe they're actually going to look at our library book, you know, borrowing records. But when it came to Barack Obama, we thought, well, he's our guy. It doesn't actually endanger us. He's trying to get the bad guys. Did you have that feeling, or were you still scared?
I was jaded by then.
Yeah.
So you used a phrase that I had never heard before, but the second you said it, I knew exactly what you were talking about. The phrase is the Great Awakening. What is that?
Yeah, this happened after I graduated college. I graduated in 2010. And shortly after that, I started to read all these news articles about students protesting really about racial and ethnic identity issues on college campuses, and using kinds of language that I didn't have when I was in college. You know, microaggressions, safe spaces, sort of these buzzwords. And it was a little confusing for me because I was basically just out of college and I went straight into grad school. So I was still on a college campus when all of this was happening. And it's remarkable how quickly the sort of top issues of college campus activism shifted.
There was some video that went around recently of the Democratic Socialists of America's their convention, and just the absurd procedures and language that they employ at their convention. Did you see that?
No, I didn't. But it makes me think of how people on the right think that Democratic Socialists are like authoritarians, and there's one person saying this is just how it's going to be. But in reality, it ends up being this, I don't know, I mean, basically like sort of an anarchical public meeting is anything but anarchy. It's tons and tons of discussion almost until you just can't bear it anymore. Is that kind of what it was like? Or are you talking more about just the sort of political correctness of it?
Well, what you've just described, you know, an anarchist run meeting, I first encountered at Occupy Wall Street. And, you know, at first I was so caught up in just the excitement of finally, you know, here's some organized protest. And, you know, I would sit in on some of these meetings and yeah, they were so slow and so procedure heavy, and it was just really obnoxious. It was disillusioning.
Yeah.
But it wasn't absurd in the way that, you know, the proceedings at the Democratic Socialists of America's convention was absurd, because it seems as though a culture has arisen. And, you know, the crass way to describe it is the oppression Olympics. You know, the more ways in which you can identify with some oppressed group, the more cachet you have, you know, the more validity your opinion carries. And one way to, you know, to get some of this additional cachet, if you happen to be white or straight or cisgendered, is you can have some sort of disability. But if, you know, your body is working fine, then you need to have some sort of mental or emotional disabilities. And it seems as though people have been encouraged to really embrace and play up any sort of, you know, emotional fragility that they might experience, because it gives them legitimacy. And that's what was really on display at this Democratic Socialists, you know, convention, asserting how fragile they were.
Quick point of privilege. Quick point of personal privilege.
Yes.
Guys, first of all, James Jackson, Sacramento, he, him. I just want to say, can we please keep the chatter to a minimum? I'm one of the people who's very, very prone to sensory overload. There's a lot of whispering and chatter going on. It's making it very difficult for me to focus. Please, can we just, I know it's, we're all fresh and ready to go, but can we please just keep the chatter to a minimum? It's affecting my ability to focus. Thank you.
Thank you, comrade. Okay, is there a speaker against name, point chapter, pronouns?
Privilege. Point of personal privilege.
Yes.
Please do not use gendered language to address everyone.
And additionally, with the noise issue, like, avoid hissing, avoid waving banners, right? Because there's all sorts of things. If you don't know what to do, show up these, right? I'm sure there's lots of ways that we can communicate to each other without needing to rely on something that's going to hurt somebody else.
Quick point of privilege once again. Hi, James Jackson, Sacramento DSA, he, him. I have already asked people to be mindful of the chatter of their comrades who are sensitive to sensory overload, and that goes double for the heckling and the hissing. It is also triggering to my anxiety. Like, the be comradely isn't just for, like, you know, let's keep things civil or whatever. It's so that people aren't going to get triggered and so that it doesn't affect their performance as a delegate, okay?
We have quiet rooms that are available. There's a range of options of these, right? Please don't go into that space with anything that's like an aggressive scent, for instance, right? Because we don't want to put people in stressful situations that they don't consent to, right? There are right-wing infiltrators who are trying to get in here, but it's going to be really traumatic for people if we're not making an affirmative effort to de-escalate each other and de-escalate ourselves, right? Take a deep breath. And feel better before you say anything.
Sort of just with mental health issues, I guess. Just
yes, and oh, it's saying, really? You know, how everybody's disabilities aren't—they're not obvious. They're not necessarily something that you can see. And, you know, the assumption being that everybody had them, and everybody's disabilities, no matter how played up or, you know, no matter how ephemeral, really had to be respected and really demanded, you know, the obedience of other people. Other people had to change their behavior in order to tiptoe around everybody else's psychological frailties.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds very difficult to get through as a participant. Yeah, and it to some extent, it just shifted way over to the other end as far as acknowledging everyone's differences and diversity. When I think about some of those buzzwords like microaggressions, I try to get past the coded language and think, okay, what they really mean is that something is offensive. And there's plenty of great examples of, you know, how these are legitimate. You wouldn't want to make a misogynistic joke around your coworkers. It just wouldn't be nice. You wouldn't want to ask somebody who has darker skin where they come from. It's just not polite. They very well may have been born in America. Or telling somebody who looks different, you know, oh wow, you have great English. You know, those things are what I think would be called microaggressions, but it's just not being polite and a good person, I think. So I try to get past that in looking at these sorts of coded language terms.
Well, there seems to be an element of mind reading in the whole microaggression sphere. You know, there's an assumption that if somebody behaves in a way that you don't like, that you have some sort of crystal clear understanding of what motivates their behavior. And that's just not the case. You know, you don't know what's going on under somebody's skull. And if they do something which seems brusque, if they do something which seems, you know, aggressive to you, even slightly aggressive, micro aggressive, you don't know what motivates that behavior.
No, not at all. I think in a lot of cases, it's just sort of ignorance. I myself grew up in a town that was almost all white, and my high school was 95% white. I had very little experience going into college and just adult life of interacting with people of different racial and ethnic identities. And so I think if I were going into the same university experience just a few years later, and I had no way to understand any of these things, maybe I don't know. I don't know how I would interact with people and how that would be different from my experience that I actually lived.
Well, this is not supposed to be about me, so I'll keep this short, but I'll say I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, which has, I think, a higher than normal African-American population. And this was a real blessing to me. I certainly didn't realize it at the time, but I didn't want to go to college. I joined the Marine Corps when I was still in high school, ended up not going into the Marines, and went to community college instead. And I went to a community college in downtown Kansas City, which, you know, is not like being a freshman at a state university. Most of the other students were working adults, you know, who were trying to get an education, a college education. And it being Kansas City, a good many of those working adults who were my classmates were Black. So, you know, I was very, my early experiences, you know, beyond high school involved a lot of interaction with people of a variety of races and people from a variety of countries, and they were adults. And then when I went to university, you know, after getting an associate's degree, the Black students at the university were largely self-segregated. They had their own fraternities and sororities. They all sat together, you know, in the cafeteria, and there was just, there was an animosity, an undercurrent of just hostility that I got, you know, and again, I don't know what's going on inside their heads, but that's how I read it at the time, you know, was just an undercurrent of hostility, you know, toward me as a white person, which was very strange coming from, you know, community college in Kansas City, Missouri. And then in my very last semester there, this was many years later because I was in grad school, I drove to New Orleans to go to a conference. And, you know, the older working class Black people in New Orleans were super friendly. I mean, people in New Orleans in general are, you know, friendly to a level which makes me uncomfortable. Uh-huh. But it was such a stark contrast to, you know, African-American student culture on campus in Columbia, Missouri in the 90s.
Yeah, that's interesting. Reminds me, I've continually tried to push myself to have more experiences with, you know, people who have different racial identities. Part of that was moving to Maryland, which has a much, much larger Black population than my home state of Massachusetts.
Well, particularly Baltimore, which is where you are.
Yes, and I didn't go straight to Baltimore, and I think that's probably a good thing because it would have been very, very different. But I, at first, was in Prince George's County, which is one of the suburban counties of Washington, D.C., and I think it's still the wealthiest majority Black county in the United States. There's maybe one in the Atlanta area that would come close, but it showed me, as someone who was just really totally ignorant to this growing up in my very white town, wow, here's a place where hundreds of thousands of Black Americans have achieved the American dream and have that McMansion in the suburbs or, you know, whatever they were hoping for. And it's a place that functions pretty well. Not all areas of the county because it's a big place, but just seeing that, wow, it's not like it is on the news where every place that is majority Black has tons of crime. And really, you know, the sort of economic standing is what's most important. I think that was a very good experience for me to have. And then moving to Baltimore, I live on along a racial dividing line in a predominantly Black neighborhood. And when I first moved here, I got involved right away in my local community organization. Most of the leaders are Black, and I've been really thankful to have those experiences to just sort of get to know and try to understand the experiences of people who have very different background than my own. So I think that may be how I've responded to the Great Awakening and just trying to be more racially conscious, you know, in the ways that I can be.
For the international viewers, if you've ever seen the TV show The Wire, it takes place in Baltimore, Maryland. And there's distinctive Baltimore patterns of speech, which many of the, you know, largely British cast of The Wire had to master. And as I was watching The Wire, I was a few years late to it, so I was catching it on DVD that I got from the library. But I was working in Newark, Delaware, which is really not that far from Baltimore. And I would hear those same patterns of speech from my coworkers. It was a strange experience.
Yeah, it is a very particular accent. I think maybe people in, if they haven't seen The Wire, from where I, you know, grew up, would think that people in Baltimore would speak with a Southern accent, but it's not the case at all. It has a very sort of particular form of speech, somewhat related to Philadelphia, but yeah, it's an interesting place here in Baltimore. I've been here for 7 years now, owned a house here for five, and it functions. You know, we get by, but the amount of violence that happens around the city is just crazy. There were gunshots in my neighborhood last night. Thankfully, I wasn't home at the time. But yeah, it's very segregated. Where you live depends, you know, on basically your race for the most part, and that shapes the experience you have. There are very, very nice neighborhoods in Baltimore, and there are places that look like they've just been bombed, like literally.
There's a toll booth on I-70. You know, if you're going to drive past Baltimore on I-70, you have to pay this toll. And there have been times in my life when I just didn't have the money and I had to get off the interstate and drive through downtown Baltimore in order to avoid a toll.
Yeah.
And I got to the point where I just made sure I had the money to pay that toll. It was a detour that was more psychological hassle than it was worth.
Yeah, you really need to keep, as a resident here, a mental map of where you think is going to be a safe place to be and where isn't. And most places during the day, it's just going to be fine. But there's a certain awareness of street smarts that applies here that I had not at all growing up, and I had to learn, and I'm probably still not very great at it, but I'm very thankful I have not been a victim of crime here. So I'm doing well so far, and life here is very affordable. One of the reasons I moved here was because Boston, you know, the big attractive city in my home state, I didn't think that I was ever going to be able to afford to own a home. And so I sought out a city on the Northeast Corridor that would offer me that opportunity. And Baltimore is great, where I can earn the income that I would similar to other large metropolitan areas. But my mortgage is minuscule compared to what some of my friends and peers have in other cities. So that's a great benefit, and it's enabled me to do more travel and just kind of live the life that I want to live.
Let's get back to electoral politics. You were an enthusiastic Obama supporter in 2008. In 2012, you voted for Jill Stein. How did 2016 shake out for you?
Well, I was a Bernie supporter, and I was so excited about his run. It was difficult to see how the system was sort of being rigged against him and how the DNC did not want him to be the nominee. But it was inspiring to see that he did so well. And in states that maybe you wouldn't expect that he would. I didn't participate actively on the campaign. I was kind of just sort of too busy with adult life. But yeah, Bernie was my guy for 2016.
And so what's been your experience with the first term of Donald Trump?
Well, I think the best thing I could say about it is that it seems his incompetence has prevented bad things from happening. There are certainly a lot of executive actions that he has taken that are just abhorrent. But really, legislatively, he went the same way as Obama. It seems as though today a president gets one big legislative action. And for Trump, it was the tax cut, which, interestingly, he didn't even really care that much about, I don't think. It was more of the Congress. So I'm thankful we haven't had anything worse than that in terms of lasting legislation. But hey, you know, I'm a white guy living in Baltimore, and I'm not that affected by sort of immigration policy. So I'm certain if I were Latino that it would be a different story.
I talked to a Mexican-American cab driver in Los Angeles who told me, you know, I'm not for the wall, but I'm totally for Trump. He's very popular among young Latinos anyway, particularly on the West Coast.
Do you, any sense of why?
I can't speak for them.
Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, there's something about his personality. It is anti-elite. And I think, you know, a lot of people just respond to that. All they know is his personality, and they mostly know his personality from before he was president, you know, when he was just a reality TV star.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I never watched his show, but I know his signature line was, "You're fired." And his self-presentation is, you know, I'm somebody who gets right to it, knows, you know, doesn't beat around the bush, and I have no patience for losers, and, you know, I'm going to get stuff done. And I'm not going to be, you know, an effete, elite, you know, East Coast or West Coast, you know, upper middle class, genteel pansy about it. I'm going to be a direct, real man. And I think, you know, that certainly, at least I can see how that would appeal to a young male Latino.
Yeah, a big, big personality. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think it's remarkable that we got this far without having someone like this who would just say whatever it is they believe in, that's that, and it doesn't matter, and their supporters will continue to support them. We had such cordial and relatively diplomatic politics for so long. I mean, sure, you can pick out candidates here and there, but in general, the establishment who actually ruled the country had it, you know, an entirely different way of going about their public decorum.
And George W. Bush had this sort of air of being a regular guy, but come on.
Folksy, very folksy.
His dad was George H.W. Bush, you know, an oil man from Texas, but also from the East Coast, and, you know, had a place in Kennebunkport, Maine. And, you know, he went to an Ivy League school. I mean, he was not a regular guy by any stretch, but he kind of presented himself that way. And Donald Trump is certainly no regular guy, but he definitely plays one on TV. And, you know, it appeals. And very few people actually make voting decisions based on policy proposals.
Yeah, the political science majors like myself, you know, it's disappointing. But yeah, that is very true. And a lot of people just decide that the day they go in the voting booth. Yeah, when they look up at, you know, the stage for the Democratic debates or what have you, they're just looking for the person that they think they identify most with, the person they could share a beer with or what have you.
The person who seems like a strong leader.
Yeah, sure.
Somebody you want to be your representative. Somebody that's fighting for you.
And, you know, with this idea that we have of American exceptionalism, I think that sort of under the surface, think that that's a requirement. That, well, America is the only one that can do what it does around the world. And so we need a strong leader. You know, what was it with Hillary Clinton? Where would you be at 3 a.m. when the call comes in or something like that? Do you remember that?
I don't.
Oh, yeah. Well, anyway, the commander-in-chief is this unique position in the world, and there's only certain people who can fill it, which I, you know, very much reject. I would rather see our military bases around the world shut down and bring the troops home.
Well, you're in luck. Troops are coming home. I was making a video today, and I'm using a graph in it of U.S. troop deployment. And, you know, I was born during the Vietnam War, so troop deployment was high. But by the time I graduated from high school in 1986, the number had been cut in half. And, you know, by 1990, 91, it plummeted much further because the Soviet Union had collapsed. And then for the first Gulf War, there's a little blip. And then for, you know, 9/11 and the war on terror, there's another little blip. But really, it's a downward trajectory. And the U.S. is definitely pulling away from its commitment to maintain global stability. And I think we're going to have some really weird, rocky times coming up, you know, on the international stage because the U.S. is packing it up and coming home.
Yeah, China is certainly challenging us in that view. And I always find it very interesting whenever I see these sort of in-depth news articles about what China is doing in Africa and elsewhere. And establishing this presence kind of under the radar of most Americans. We know that they send us lots of cheap stuff, but I don't think that most Americans realize the amount of power that they're developing around the world.
You know, they're trying to develop what's called soft power by opening cultural centers and Chinese schools and, you know, building infrastructure in other nations so that they can secure the supplies that they need for their own economy. But the Chinese have no prayer whatsoever of ever matching the United States in naval power. And things don't look good for China, really, long term. I think they're probably going to break up into a variety of regional countries. And internationally, things are just not looking bright for China whatsoever. And their One Belt, One Road initiative, you know, one thing about giving a lot of aid to countries that are ruled by corrupt kleptocrats is that most of the money you give them ends up in Swiss bank accounts, and the stuff that you thought would get built doesn't. And the Chinese are coming to this realization now. And at the same time, while they're throwing all this money around internationally, still a huge part of the Chinese population are rural farmers who are living a really hand-to-mouth existence. You know, the average income in China is still less than $2 a day.
Is it still?
Huh. Yeah. So, you know, we see these prosperous images of Shenzhen and Shanghai and whatnot, but that's not China. I mean, that's a few spots in China. That's Chinese.
Yeah. I've thought a lot about what happens once the Chinese economy actually starts to slow down or shrinks, and whether that will really throw everything into chaos, because I think this is definitely a very American point of view I have, but looking at them, it just seems as though the attractiveness of the regime is that they can continuously grow the economy at these huge rates and bring people material prosperity. And that's how they can make the case successfully that their system is better than what we have in the West of more democratic political and economic systems.
I'm going to stop the conversation there for this episode. I'll play the rest in the next episode. But for now, I just want to reflect on a few things. First, I want to say that if you look at a map of Baltimore, my talking about having to get off of I-70 to avoid a toll booth doesn't make a lot of sense. I-70 starts just west of Baltimore. So it's really I-95. That's where that toll booth is. And it's not so much that I felt you know, physically threatened by the people of Baltimore. It's just that the city, it's an unfamiliar city to me, and to get off of an interstate highway and to be, you know, thrust into a strange city with people just drive different in the city, you know? And to go from living in the exurbs and driving in the exurbs to being thrust into a strange urban environment, unfamiliar urban environment, It's just really stressful. And, you know, to be thrust into a strange urban environment because you don't have the $3 or whatever it costs, you know, to stay on the interstate, that's an additional level of stress. I experimented with fasting last December and then again in March of this year. I think it was March. And this is something from Noah Harari's book, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. It's a very different experience to not eat because you're fasting than it is to not eat because you don't have any money. So to be forced off the interstate into a stressful and unfamiliar environment because you don't have a trivial amount of money is a very different experience than, you know, deciding to go exploring in some strange environment. There's a level of stress built into the very fabric of the first instance, which is decidedly lacking in the second. You know, if you decide you want some adventure, you know, whatever else is going on in your life, you probably don't have a lot of baseline stress. Unless, of course, you know, upping your anxiety level is your way of dealing with the stress, which I know for some people it is. I mean, that's, I guess, largely the appeal of like first-person shooter and other, you know, action and violence-heavy video games. But I want to talk about China. I know it's a, given where I started, you know, this segment, that's a strange departure. But, you know, that's where we left off the conversation with Phil, was talking about China. And where we'll pick up, you know, is the segue away from that topic in the next episode. So as I mentioned to Philip, I've been reading, not reading, I need to make that distinction because it's a different experience. I listened to the audiobook of Peter Zeihan's The Absent Superpower, The Shale Revolution and a World Without America. And in it, he describes a variety of, I guess from his perspective, plausible future scenarios about coming conflicts, which will be the result of the United States withdrawing from, you know, withdrawing its military forces from its overseas bases and letting the world do as it will. And prior to, you know, the global order established at the end of World War II, where the United States did offer to make the world safe for global trade in exchange for the major powers letting the United States coordinate their defense so that there could be an internationally coordinated response to the Soviet Union, well, the Soviet Union's long gone. And the global order that the U.S. established to contain the Soviet Union continued under its own momentum for a couple of decades, but it's been winding down. And Peter Zeihan's contention is not only will it continue to wind down, but there will be a distinct change in, you know, the way that countries operate when the United States is no longer guaranteeing maritime stability and safety. When in order to get a valuable cargo from one place, you know, one part of the planet to another, you will have to escort it with military vessels. And in talking about Asia, the big Asian four powers there, Taiwan, Japan, South Korea, and China, they all depend on imports, mostly of petroleum, but of other things as well. And there will be competition between those four powers for control of the sea lanes. And Peter Zeihan's contention is that Japan has a really excellent navy compared to just about anybody except the United States. They have overwhelming naval superiority. And in this environment, it is naval superiority which will rule the day. But China's got a lot of other troubles going for it. And in fact, I did a video yesterday in which I summarized a lot of those problems. Much of what I talked about came from Peter Zeihan's book, but since I listened to the audiobook of The Absent Superpower, I've been doing other reading on the topic. And, you know, once I got away from the book, I was mostly reading, not listening. Maybe a little aside about audiobooks. I have a subscription to Audible, so I get a credit for a new audiobook from Audible every month. But sometimes I'll also take advantage of their offer to buy 3 additional credits at a discounted rate. So I listen to a lot of audiobooks. And I've kind of gotten into a pattern where if I think I might be interested in reading a book, I get the audiobook and I listen to it. And if it's really good and it's engaging, but it's dense in a way that, you know, I have trouble following an audiobook form, or I think there's stuff there that I would get more out of if I want to read it, then I'll seek out either a Kindle copy or a paper copy. So with The Absent Superpower, I'm on my second listen through. And in fact, I skipped parts of it because the Twilight War, which is basically Russia looking to reoccupy the footprint of the old Soviet Union along its western border, because it's a much shorter border to defend. And it also takes advantage of terrain, coastlines, mountains, you know, waterways and such, to create natural borders, whereas Russia, the outline of the country of Russia, doesn't really match up with any natural border. It's a very hard space to defend. And Russia, well, I'm not going to go into detail on this, but I skipped over, you know, re-listening to that. I thought I pretty much got it the first time. I skipped over about half of the next Gulf War scenario that he laid out, and I jumped right back to the tanker war, which is this struggle for supremacy, you know, naval supremacy in Northeast Asia in, you know, the coming decades. And China has, as I mentioned, it is a very large, you know, inland country. Much of it is landlocked, but the prosperous, dynamic cities are mostly on the coast, the exception being the capital. And the internal transportation of fossil fuels is mostly geared to keeping the capital supplied. And the southern cities of Shenzhen and Guangzhou and Hong Kong, which are all, you know, right next to one another, they're very far south. They're very far away from the capital. There's a vast mountainous region which divides them from the rest of the country. They really are dependent on imports over water. But China has other problems that it's facing. I think it's Peter Zeihan. I'm in this weird position where, you know, I read one book or listened to one book, and then I started seeking out additional information sources on the same topic, and they all kind of blend together in my head. But I think it was Peter Zeihan who said that China's military is largely a force for internal social control. It is not geared to fighting other countries, or, you know, certainly not geared to invading other countries. China has large populations of non-Han Chinese ethnic minorities. If you go to the Wikipedia page and you look at the list of them, you know, where they are, what they're called, and how many of them there are, you have to scroll to see the whole list. It is a long list. And, you know, a lot of these folks are not particularly interested in being lumped in with China. They don't consider themselves to be Chinese. The ones we hear about most often in the West are the Muslim Uyghurs. And I think we hear about them mostly because of the re-education camps that China has set up and the stories from Uyghurs who get out of China, you know, and escape to neighboring countries. And they can tell about how the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party, has treated them. So there's a lot of, internal dissatisfaction. The wealth of China, as I mentioned in the conversation with Philip, is not broadly shared. The people living in the countryside, well, let me read an article from Forbes magazine. This is from 2017. It's by Kenneth Raposa, who writes, China's getting old. In fact, they are getting older faster than anywhere else in the world, and the Chinese government has a very weak safety net to cover for them all. According to the United Nations, China is aging more rapidly than almost any country in recent history. China's dependency ratio for retirees could rise as high as 44% by 2050. The dependency ratio compares the difference between those not in the labor force with those who are working, or can work, full-time. It is a yardstick geared to measure the pressure on taxable income going to support entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicaid in the U.S., for example. China's aging population is as big a worry as its debt bomb, if not more so, because China can make its debt disappear at a stroke of a pen, but the government cannot make millions of elderly and retirees disappear. For Wall Street, China's unfavorable demographics are worth watching. It would be different if this was some rich Nordic country or Japan, an Asian neighbor with its own demographic woes. China is getting old at a time when its middle-income earners and the entrepreneurial class is still in the early innings of spreading its wings. These financial strains on the government will force policymakers to reevaluate spending, and that could easily threaten economic stimulus programs investors have come to expect from Beijing in times of economic slowdowns. I'll stop there because, as you can tell, this being Forbes magazine, it shifts into the mindset and speaks to the concerns of Western investors in China, which I'm not really talking about here. I mean, China is getting old faster than any other country in the world. And part of that is to do with their one-child policy. Basically, a one-child policy cuts the number of family lines in half. You know, you've got the family line of the father, the family line of the mother. If only one child can come of those two family lines, then you're creating an artificial population bottleneck, which is going to have demographic ripples down the road. And we're still a few decades out from that. But China was, you know, the Chinese Communist Party and central government was less able to enforce that one-child mandate out in the countryside. And one of the results of that was that people in the city who did abide by the one-child policy, you know, one effect of cutting in half the number of, you know, future family lines is that you're concentrating inherited wealth. You know, for each little emperor, each only child who receives the, you know, the inherited wealth of two family lines, well, compare that to what happens to inherited wealth out in the countryside, where the farmers needed multiple children and continued to have them throughout the one-child period. But then you got an economic situation where a lot of people were being drawn away from the countryside to go work in the factories in the cities. Interestingly, mostly young women going from the countryside into the cities to work in these factories, because the differences, the psychological, behavioral differences between men and women make it possible to pack women into these tiny claustrophobic dormitories which are attached to the factories where they work. And you can concentrate them with less violence and social friction than you can concentrate young men in the same way. And because the work is, you know, largely assembly work, which is, it's not like construction work or other work where superior physical upper body strength is really going to make any sort of difference. You know, what the people working in the factories in Shenzhen require is an ability to, you know, focus their attention for many hours at a time on a repetitive task. But the result is that you've got a lot of young men out in the countrysides who have absolutely no prospect of ever getting married. And young men in that situation are much more amenable to violent political fantasies about how they can channel their own natural male gift for violence, in this case collective violence, into some sort of new and better world, some better path for their society. And I don't know the details of these, you know, the various narratives that would be competing to gain that resource, you know, the violent capacity of young men. But just, you know, given what we know about human nature and human psychology, surely an environment where there's a lot of poverty and a lot of men with no prospect of ever having a wife or children, you know, that's a bad situation. Also, a lot of the people out in the countryside, I mean, that's where the demographic transition is really going to hit hard. There are a lot of older, poor farmers out in the Chinese countryside. And, you know, China calls itself a communist country, calls itself a socialist country, but it doesn't have much of a social safety net, particularly out in the countryside, where it is hard to deliver services, where, you know, roads are pretty sketchy, and there isn't high-speed rail, and there aren't airports. There's a YouTube channel that I like to watch called ADV China, and it's basically these two guys. One's American, one's South African, but they both lived in China for over a decade. They're both motorcycle enthusiasts, and they have a drone, and they have GoPro cameras attached to their helmets, and they have, you know, a radio link so they can talk while they're riding around in China, and they would just ride their motorcycles around and, you know, take drone footage and talk about stuff and record it. And, you know, that's their videos. And there's plenty of footage of them riding around the shiny big cities in China, but there's also footage of them riding around out in the countryside. And there's this one image that really struck me. There was a young man out in the countryside, just standing on the street, not doing much of anything, but he had a very large dead rat hanging from his belt. What's that about? Well, that was dinner. He was going to be eating that dead rat later that day. And he didn't look, he looked very normal. His demeanor didn't indicate that he was really self-conscious about carrying around a big dead rat, that this was just part of his life. And I realize, you know, the limitations of what you can infer from one anecdote, or particularly one image. But the images that we get of China, of this high-tech, prosperous urban nation, are definitely not the full picture. And what I've discovered is that when you do a video and you put the China tag in the description, you get people commenting on your video who don't comment on most of your videos. I mean, they're not people who watch and take in everything that I put up. But if I mention China, they show up and they post really anti-American, really pro-Chinese sentiments in perfect English. And it just makes me wonder who they are and what they're about, because YouTube is not available in China. I mean, to get YouTube in China, you have to have a VPN. So at this point, I want to pop over to Wikipedia. The 50 Cent Party or 50 Cent Army is the colloquial term for internet commentators, which are hired by Chinese authorities in an attempt to manipulate public opinion to the benefit of the Chinese Communist Party. It was created during the early phases of the Internet's rollout to the wider public in China. The name derives from the allegation that commentators are said to be paid 50 cents in renminbi for every post, though some speculate that they are probably not paid anything for the posts, instead being required to do so as part of their official party duties. They create favorable comments on articles on popular Chinese social media networks that are intended to derail discussions that are unhelpful to the Communist Party and promote narratives that serve the government's interests. Together with disparaging comments and misinformation about political opponents and critics of the Chinese government, both domestic and abroad. It is also used as a derogatory term against people with perceived pro-CPC or Chinese nationalist views. A 2016 Harvard University paper found that, in contrast to more common assumptions, the 50-cent army consists mostly of paid bureaucrats who respond to government directives in times of crisis and flood Chinese social media with pro-government comments. They also rarely engage in direct arguments. Around 80% of the analyzed posts involve pro-China cheerleading with inspirational slogans, and 13% involve general praise and suggestions on governmental policies. Research indicated a massive secretive operation to fill China's internet with propaganda, which has resulted in some 488 million posts carried out by fake social media accounts, representing about 0.6% of the 80 billion posts generated on Chinese social media. To maximize their influence, such pro-government comments are made largely during times of intense online debate and when online protests have a possibility of transforming into real-life actions. So I'm going to skip most of the details of this and just head on down to the very end, where it talks a little bit about how this has spilled out to the internet outside of China. The internet commentator 50 Cent Party activities were described by CPC General Secretary Chinese President Hu Jintao as, quote, a new pattern of public opinion guidance, close quote. They represent a shift from simply erasing dissenting opinions to guiding dialogue. In 2010, a contributor to the Huffington Post stated that some comments she received on one of her posts were from the 50 Cent Party. She also stated that the 50 Cent Party monitors popular U.S. websites, news sites, and blogs and posts comments that advance Chinese governmental interests. David Wertheim of Foreign Policy argued that the narrative where a large army of paid internet commentators are behind China's poor public dialogue with its critics is, quote, Orwellian yet strangely comforting, close quote. Rather, many of the Chinese netizens spreading nationalist sentiment online are not paid, but often mean what they say. In Australia, the term has been used pejoratively in the ongoing debate over Chinese influence in the country. So now, let me skip from there and read to you some comments that I've received on my videos. So for example, anytime I do a video that mentions China, I get comments from a YouTube user who calls himself or herself unelected leader, and the avatar is a picture of Xi Jinping. So, unelected leader posted to my most recent video, which mentions the absent superpower and Peter Zeihan and the speculations about the coming tanker war in Northeast Asia. Unelected leader writes, Zeihan is conning you guys and his audiences, lol. He knows full well that China beat up America in Korea and again in Vietnam. These were direct fights between the USA and the PRC. The USA sued for peace and Nixon came to China and Bretton Woods and trade were granted to China. Here's the Cold War. USSR lost it, USA survived it, PRC won it. And another commenter who goes by the handle Melkor Tolkien. Melkor was Sauron's boss, basically. Melkor Tolkien writes, 95% of China's population is Han Chinese. Ethnic conflicts will be nulled. Not nullified, but nulled. I think the United States has more of a possibility of splitting up than China. As for China and Japan, China has nukes, the ultimate coup de grace. China and Russia have more of a reason to pair up against the U.S. than to fight each other. China also has space capabilities and a planned space station by 2021-22. Japan, on the other hand, has none of these and a disaster demographic right now, not to mention in the coming decades. So, Melkor Tolkien and unelected leader, are they members of the 50 Cent Army? Or do they just, hold pro-communist Chinese party opinions and seek out places to express those opinions online? I don't know. but it certainly has piqued my curiosity. All right, I'm heading for the exit here, but it's going to take a few minutes to tie up the various threads of this episode. So I've largely been making reference to this book, The Absent Superpower by Peter Zeihan. And in it, he's mostly talking about military power and access to, you know, fossil fuels, specifically petroleum. And something he doesn't mention in the book, but which I know, having listened to some of his interviews, is he's certainly aware of it, is the topic of automation. So the beginning of the book, you know, before he gets into any of this geopolitical stuff, he does a very deep dive into the nitty-gritty of petroleum extraction and production here in the United States, particularly the so-called shale revolution. Now, if you've been listening to what I've been putting out for years, you know that when I was giving a more than a fair hearing to the peak oil narrative, you would hear from people who said that fracked wells they have a very short productive lifespan. They require too much infrastructure, too much invested energy for the returned energy, and that the financing didn't work. And yet here we are, a decade later, throughput is as high as it's ever been. Prices are low. They have been low. The financing continues to work. Yeah, a lot of players have gone broke, but in terms of the amount of hydrocarbons being extracted from fractured shale, the numbers are high and they're consistently high. So the peak oil narrative and suite of explanations as to why the so-called shale revolution couldn't last were simply wrong. Their conclusion was not borne out, and their arguments, you know, given the reality that we have now, 10 years later, were clearly faulty. What happened? How is it that this, you know, this technology, which was supposed to be this very short-term, you know, reprieve, has turned into a sustainable flow of energy such that the United States it now exports a lot of petroleum products. And while it still imports some, it is very close to being energy independent. And if current trends continue, will be a net exporter within the next year or two. How could that happen? Well, unfortunately, the answer is technology and more specifically automation. What is the most expensive part of any, you know, large-scale coordinated venture? It's people. Well, just like every other part of the technological economy, the shale producers have figured out how to cut expensive human beings out of the process and automate where they can, and it has brought the price of American shale oil down to the same as Saudi conventional oil, and that process hasn't run its course. Again, quite soon, and if you're listening in the future, this is probably already in the rearview mirror, shale oil production in Texas is on track to be cheaper than conventional oil production in Saudi Arabia. And this is before the Yazidi rebels, supposedly, Yazidi rebels took out the Abqaiq refinery, you know, with drones and missiles. So this brings us back around to, you know, my perpetual topic of interest these days, and that is artificial intelligence and how quickly things are moving in that sphere now. I listened to a book a while back which described the various national, you know, the published, acknowledged national agendas of the top 20 nations in terms of, you know, what their stated objectives are in terms of coordinated national efforts toward artificial intelligence development. The United States has none. No policy. When we talk about the competition between the United States and China, really we're talking about the competition between the Pentagon and the Silicon Valley corporations with which it contracts, and China. And I want to play a couple of rounds of question and answer. This is with Ian Bremmer. He is a geopolitical analyst. He's written a number of books, and his most recent book is called Us Versus Them, The Failure of Globalism. And I'm thinking about getting it on Audible, and the only thing holding me back is that it's only 5 hours long, and Audible credits are fairly expensive. I want 15 to 20 hours worth of, you know, entertainment and or education out of an Audible credit. 5 hours doesn't quite cut it. But he's got lots of good material that you can find on YouTube. And that is where I got the clips that you're about to hear. These come from the very end of a long YouTube question and answer series and an interview actually with Kevin Rudd, the former Prime Minister of Australia. It is Kevin Rudd who is selecting the questioners from the audience.
The next question up the front here, please. Yeah.
So, Bob Rosenkranz, Intelligence Squared Debates. So, if you took a somewhat utopian view of a technological future in which we could enjoy material abundance with very little or much reduced labor input, what, I mean, there is an example in the world that looks sort of like that, and it's the Emirates, and it's a pretty unhappy example. How, this is a more existential or philosophical question, what does a world look like where material abundance comes without much work?
If it comes with, it's a great question, and if it comes with our existing political system and social safety net, then it will end up with enormous numbers of people that are dehumanized. Because what will happen, right, in all of this abundance is that you're going to be changing people. Right, within 30, 40 years, you're going to have people that are, you know, very differently abled through technology, through the drugs they can take, through the enhancements they can have. We're already doing this with our military in the United States in ways that most people here are not aware of. Read up on DARPA if you don't know about this stuff, right? I mean, people that will not need to sleep as much to function well, people that will have highly, you know, better memories, much more capable of doing the jobs that they're available to do. Those will be expensive. Those will not be available to everyone unless you have a social safety net that is very different than what we experience in the West right now. Now, look, we already have something like this on the planet. It's the way we treat animals, right? I mean, we love animals, right? And yet we've convinced ourselves that livestock are not conscious and don't feel pain. And we need to do that, because if you don't do that, it would be really hard for us to live as human beings, right, with the way we actually treat livestock, which is incredibly inhumane. And they are tasty, right? I mean, so I accept that. And look, and I don't care. No, we've gotten to the point that people that talk about human, people talk about animal rights in polite society are kind of a little fringe. They're a little weird. They're kind of too into it, right? Like, I mean, you're glad that they're there, but you don't really want them at your dinner parties, right? Because it's like, you know, hey, we're going to serve normal food and we're going to wear leather and just go away. But the ability of human beings to support things, to internalize things, to vote for things that are really not okay is really high when we're not given other solutions. We find ways to tolerate the intolerable. And I really believe that for all of the utopian promise of technology, and that is the new religion. If anyone is developing a religion in the world today, it's Yuval Harari and Homo Deus and Elon Musk and the singularity with Ray Kurzweil, all these guys, and they are all guys, and that also tells us something. They're literally all guys. We should not believe that if technology takes away the jobs and creates abundance, that is going to be anything close to well-distributed. There's no reason to believe that. There's every reason to believe that won't be true. Everything in human history, temperament, and genetic makeup tells you that won't happen. So we need to address it now, when actually times are relatively flush and we have some cash. The Italians have just voted in a completely ridiculous group of people. They can't form a government, right? But if they do come in, or if they have a new election, which they probably will, and you get an even worse outcome, they'll be able to spend a lot of money. Because they've got a lot of money, because growth is picking up a little bit now. The Germans will give them some flexibility, right? That's the time that you want to try to say, okay, let's make sure that in all this money we're spending, let's do it in some ways that make some sense for the long term. Because the U.S. right now, that budget, a lot of money being spent, not a lot of smart money being spent. Not a lot of things that are going to address the concerns that you have.
We have time for a couple more questions. A gentleman over here for a question. Can someone tell me what the time is? I have neither a clock or a watch.
Okay. I'm Dr. Robert Lester. I'm a retired college professor from Nassau Community College. My question deals with an article in Foreign Affairs, the latest edition, written by Susan Lunds and Laura Tyson, where they would argue globalization is not a retreat, it's not a failure, and they insist that digital technology is saving globalization. and they believe the movement of data, I'm quoting from them, is already surpassing traditional trade as the connective tissue in the global economy, and that the past globalization was dominated by the West. Not anymore. Now it's going to be dominated by China, and the vortex of the global of globalization will be in the Far East, which will extend, of course, to Australia as well. And
which will be in the part of China. Yeah, okay.
And according to the article, 42% of China's 42% of all e-commerce transactions, the trade and services are increasing. Digital platforms will make it easier for small business to reach customers. South and South trade is increasing. And AI will be dominated by China and the Far East, and that will be the center of globalization. Doctor, did you read the article? Or Prime Minister, did you have a chance to read that article? Or I would like you to both gentlemen to comment on that, please.
Over to Professor Bremer.
With one small caveat, I think they're both right, 100%. They're economists. You will note that they talked about globalization. My book is not about globalization, but the globalism. Mm. I actually say at the beginning of the book, I think that globalization has been a great success. It has taken billions of people out of poverty, particularly in Asia. And absolutely true that most trade is increasingly about data and services, which is not counted in, you know, sort of, it's not NAFTA, for example. It's one of the reasons TPP was important. It was going to include that. It wasn't there. So absolutely true. The problem is that if globalization is working and picking up speed and increasingly dominated by Asia, but that a majority of the population of the West feels that the political ideology that went with globalization, globalism, does not work for them, you have a crisis. And crises frequently lead to wars. Now, I'm a political scientist, right? So the fact that the politics have not responded adequately to the successes and discontents of globalization, and those are not, by the way, just economic. We talked about culture, security, technology. Here's the place where I push back. They have no idea whether AI will be won by China or not. Right now, there are two countries in the world that are fighting a war over AI. It's the U.S. and China. There are a bunch of companies. Some of them are private sector U.S. Some of them are state-supported in China. But I will tell you this. If the Chinese win the AI war, decidedly win it, that's probably the end of the liberal democratic model as a globally sustainable political ideology. I'm willing to say that.
All right, so there you have it. If the U.S. does not win in this competition with China to develop and deploy AI, that's it for representative democracy as an international norm. It doesn't mean that we'll be, you know, ruled by the Communist Chinese Party here in the United States, but it means that the default assumption that liberal democracy will be the international lingua franca of politics, that assumption will be proven false. You know, part of China's Belt and Road Initiative is not just to build pipelines and build railways and open, you know, Chinese language and culture schools in Africa and other Asian nations. They are exporting their AI-enabled social control, their social credit score, their surveillance technology, and most likely the suite of techniques which they have developed and continue to develop to control the narrative, to control discussions online. If you're going to be a junior partner to China, you're going to do as China does in terms of monitoring and controlling dissent and locking down and squashing any democracy movements before they can pick up any steam. So if you are still of the mind that really AI is just flashy bling, it is nothing particularly important, and what we really need to focus on is gardening because peak oil, I think you've moved from just being obsessive to being dysfunctionally obsessive about a particular topic. I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.